My wife tells me the movie Noah is coming out at the end of this month, and it looks interesting because there's a lot of fighting in it. I'm still a guy, I guess. I like that stuff, the Lord of the Rings and orcs and, you know, all that. But talking about wiping out the human race, have you ever thought about why God did not wipe out Adam and Eve right when they were sinned? Think about an art class and you're making a pot and it goes wrong. What do? You crumple it all up and you start over. Could have been very easy for God to have done that from the beginning. But why didn't he? Only logical explanation is to reveal his son, Jesus Christ, to the world. Because his son is going to come and save not only Adam and Eve, but all those who would follow their bad examples. So the only reason for human history is to reveal Jesus Christ. Everything that you see, everything that happened, all the wars, all the dominations, and all of that, all of human history points to one thing and one thing only, and there's one reason for it, and that is Jesus Christ. So we're not only talking about the church context or the biblical context, but everything points to Christ. All human principles, such as church, family, state, marriage, are pointing to the reality of Jesus Christ. For example, marriage is significant in our minds and in all cultures' minds throughout all of history, because no matter where you go in the world, somehow people believe in marriage, and it's the craziest thing. Why would you bind yourself one man or one woman for the rest of your life? What sense does it make? And yet people have been giving themselves into that tradition for thousands and thousands of years. Why? Because God invented marriage to illustrate to us what it will be like to have a relationship with an almighty God who will be our bridegroom. You see, marriage didn't just happen by itself, and then God looks at our world and go, what will best describe how I feel about them? Oh, marriage, yeah, they're big into that. No, he invented marriage for the purpose of, in order to reveal Jesus Christ to us more clearly. So you see how everything points to the person of Christ. It's all about Jesus. And not just the Bible, again, it's entire history. And for the last several weeks, we've been looking more specifically at some biblical characters from the Old Testament and discovered how they point, how they play the supporting role to the main character of Jesus Christ. For example, Abraham and his only son, Isaac, being offered to God, serves as a precursor to Jesus, ultimately the Son of God who was offered on the cross, on the top of the wood. And then we looked at Joseph and how he was despised and betrayed by his brothers, but yet he worked for their good, for their prosperity. And just like that, Jesus, although he was betrayed by the very people he came to save, and yet he said, "Forgive them, for they do not know what they do," and he died on the wood to save them. And then last week, Pastor LD talked about Moses and how he led the people of Israelites 40 years in the desert and failing miserably because all of them died. All of the first generation died in the desert, not living up to the temptation that they were faced with. And then we hear about Jesus spending 40 days in the desert, meeting Satan's temptations head on and passing them with flying colors. Again, doing what the Israelites couldn't do, doing what you and I couldn't do. And so he lived a life that you and I should have lived, perfect life that we always wished we have lived. Jesus has lived for us and for them. And so we see once again how Jesus is a better Abraham, Jesus is a better Joseph, Jesus is a better Moses, and today we'll see how Jesus is a better Jacob. You realize that I'm kind of out of sync. I totally forgot Jacob. Jacob falls between Abraham and Joseph. And so now we're kind of going back and inserting Joseph into that story. So my bad, but I think it's better that we do that because it's kind of an important figure. I mean, his name changes to Israel later on, and it's the nation Israel, you know, which God uses to evangelize the whole world. And so we don't want to skip him, all right? So giving you a little context, Abraham, at 100 years old, has his son after waiting 25 years. And so Abraham has Isaac. Okay? And Isaac at age 40 gets married and waits 20 years to have his first child or children. And those children are Esau and Jacob. So Jacob is a second son of Isaac, who is the son of Abraham. So Abraham is Jacob's grandfather, okay? So just to give you a context. Now, there were twins, Esau and Jacob. Esau beat out Jacob by 1 minute, or however long it took Rebekah, the mother, to push the second time. So Esau beat him out by just the hair. But Esau, the older son, was favored by his father, Isaac, because he was a man's man. Right? He liked to hunt. He liked to play games. So in today's term, he's a son that likes to play football, that likes to play rough, right? And so he was favored by Isaac, right? The father. However, Jacob, the main character that we're going to be talking about today, was a mama's boy. Rather than going hunting, he would rather stay home and watch Duck Dynasty, right? And help with her mama's cooking. And so he was favored by Rebecca, the mother. And this causes all kinds of problems. And so here's a mini lesson. It's not one of the main lessons. Parents, I beg you not to show favoritism with your children. Don't even entertain the thought. And you know how your friends or some parents come and tempt you? Like, who do you really favor? Which one do you really like? Don't ever give in to that and don't ever say it. Why? Because words have power. And as soon as you say which child, not only does that person know that, but it gets lodged in your head. In your head, oh yeah, that's my favorite child. And you know what? It's going to come out. You can't hide it. Your kids will find out. So if you have played a favoritism in your head, your kids are going to find it's going to jack their lives up. And so don't even entertain the thought and don't ever give in to the temptation when somebody asks you which one is your favorite. And please don't ask anybody that kind of stupid question. So many people in the Bible messed up their lives because of favoritism over and over and over. And we see a primary example of that in today's story. Okay? So mini lesson for you. All right. So finally, time comes for the blessing ceremony for Isaac and Esau. So the boys, you know, grew up from that, from their childhood. And the blessing, we are not familiar with this, but right before the father dies, he would take his older son, in this case Esau, and he would put his hand on his head, and he would bless him. He would pray a blessing ask God to bless him with prosperity and with descendants and children, and also his heritage would go to the first son. And so Isaac, knowing that he doesn't have many days left, tells Esau and tells him to go hunt an animal, prepare it the way I like it, bring it back, we'll eat together, and then I'll bless you. That was the deal. But hearing this, Rebecca, remember, she favored the younger son, and she wants the younger son to be blessed instead of the older son, quickly gathers Jacob and tells Jacob, do this, all right? We're going to deceive your father. We want to make sure that the blessing goes to you and not to your brother. I want you to put this goat hair on, because Esau, his brother, had hairy skin, and then I want you to put his coat, because he had this outdoorsman's smell, so put his coat. And all of this she's thinking in her head, because Isaac, the father, can't see well. So he will have to feel, and he will have to hear, and he will have to rely on other senses. And so she is devising this evil scheme for her younger son to be preferred over the older son. And Jacob, at first, he's not sure. If he finds out, he's going to curse me, and that's not going to go well. But he decides, I'm going to trust my mama, and he decides to go along with the whole plan. And so quickly, he does all of that, and then comes, and Isaac, you know, is this really, how come it doesn't sound like you? And Jacob says, it is your son. It is your first son, Esau, trust me. And plan works, believe it or not. Plan works. And right after Isaac blesses the wrong son, Jacob, you know what happens, right? Esau walks in. And finding out what happened, how do you think Esau reacted? Remember, he just hunted a game. Right? He just killed an animal. What do you think he had in his hand What do you think he wanted to do? That's right, he wanted to kill his brother. And so Jacob flees. Jacob flees the scene. And Rebecca, the mother, tells Jacob, well, I have a brother, your uncle, that lives in a nearby country. I want you to go and live with him for a while until your brother's anger subsides. And so he goes. And there at his uncle's house, Jacob meets his match in meeting a master pro-deceiver. Right? So lesson one, and there are three big lessons for us to learn. So lesson one is this. God often chooses us in spite of our evil and not because of our goodness. God often chooses us not because of our goodness, but in spite of our evil. Why do you think God picked Jacob instead of Esau, the second son, and it would have been normally the first son? Why do you think God chose Jacob? Normally, we would think, you know, there must be something in Jacob's life. You know, maybe they were both bad, but maybe he wasn't as bad. But when we read about Jacob, I mean, he was a scoundrel. He was a deceiver. And on top of that, he was a mama's boy. I'm sorry, I have something against mama's boy. All right? You know, I grew up playing baseball and, you know, roughhousing and all that. And I just, yeah. So, I mean, he was a mama's boy. What is there to like? There was not anything that God should prefer Jacob over Esau. And yet, God picks Jacob. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with their demeanor or their personality, because this was pre-decided before they were born. Right? Before they were born, before they came out of the womb, God tells Rebecca that it's going to be your second son, the younger son, that will serve your older son. And maybe that influenced her somewhat in her thinking and why she favored the younger son. But this was predetermined. God did not look at, well, you know, I'm going to wait till they turn five and then see how they do, and I'm going to prefer the one that's better than the other. No! It was predetermined even before they were born, which one God was going to pick. So it has nothing whatsoever to do with their attitude, with their demeanor, or with their personality. It all depends on God's sovereignty. It was God's sovereign choice. And it's called grace. It's called grace. You may not like that, because that feels like God is destroying our free will, right? We have no say in this. We have no control in this. It all depends on God, but depending on where you're coming from, right? If you're a Christian, that means don't delude yourself that God made you his child because there's something good in you. Don't delude yourself thinking like that, right? In that case, if that were true, then that means you have earned God's favor and you get the credit, right? Because there's something in me, it's because of something that I've done or something that maybe bad things that I have not done compared to my other people, that God saw that and God saw goodness in it and God chose me. That's not grace, right? That's you working for it. You have earned it. But that's not how grace works. It has nothing whatsoever to do with you. It has everything to do with God. Even though you and I were evil, even though there was not an ounce of goodness in us, God chose us in spite of who we are. God demonstrated his own love for us in this, that while we were sinners, right? While we were sinners, while we were still rebellious, while we were still doing evil things, and we had no mindset to turn away from those things, Christ died for us. Christ cared for us, and Christ chose us. So all credit goes to God and none to us. Implication is stay humble, right? As Christians, we cannot help but stay humble. Do not look to an unbeliever and think, well, you know, God picked me and I'm a child of God, and God didn't pick him because he's an unbeliever. Well, there must be something in my life, right, that I've done right. I don't know exactly what it is, but there must be something that I've done right, and that's why God chose me. Absolutely not. Right? If anything, you are worse than that person, right? And God chose you just to show how great he really is. God chooses the scumsy of the earth, transforms them, and makes them something great just so that God will get the credit. So if you feel like a scum of the earth, good for you. You're right in God's will. And God uses people like you. Christianity says, it's not my goodness that's getting me to heaven. It's Christ's goodness in spite of my evil that's getting me to heaven. So Christ gets all glory and honor. It's all about him. Okay. Now back to the story. Now Jacob is about to be schooled by the master deceiver, right? Pro deceiver. And this is how it happened. You see, Jacob goes and flees his brother, goes to his uncle's house, and he meets this beautiful girl named Rachel, right? There are only three people in all the Bible that Bible uses this particular word to describe a woman, and beautiful, and Rachel is one of them. And Jacob's eyes are, you know, wow, I want this one, I want to know who this woman is. Come to find out that she is his cousin, Uncle Laban's daughter, and he wants to marry this girl. I know that's like, ew, cousin. Back in this time, that was allowed. That was perfectly okay, and actually they prefer to marry within your own family, all right? And so he wants to have this girl as his wife, and so he goes to Uncle Laban, and Laban, remember, the uncle is the master deceiver, right? Jacob is just junior varsity to this guy. And so he sees how this boy is in love with her, with his daughter. And so he proposes a plan. Hey, you know, you work for me for 7 years, and because he already found out that he's a good, skilled worker. You work for me, you labor for me 7 years, and I'll give you my daughter to you. And what do you think Jacob did? Yeah, 7 years? Okay, I will work for you. And so he worked 7 hard years, and he was a good worker, good shepherd, doing a lot of things, and God blessed, and Laban became rich because of that. And so after 7 years, right, his passion's burning. It's like, give me my wife, right? Give me Rachel. And so they get married. They go into, they spend the first night, and then, you know, Jacob, I'm sure is as happy as he can be. Wakes up in the morning and realizes that it was Leah, Rachel's older sister. He slept with, not Rachel, but with the wrong girl, with her sister, older sister, Leah. Jacob is flabbergasted, right? By the way, no electric lights, okay? And heavily veiled, and so that's why they can make that kind of mistake. It's like, how do you miss, you know, were you drunk? No, that could happen, okay, even though you were not. Maybe he was drunk, too, okay, on top of that. Anyway, so Jacob is furious, right? Why this deception? And he demands an answer from his Uncle Laban. Why would you do this? And Uncle Laban calmly and collectively says, well, in our tradition, in our culture, country, that we cannot let the younger daughter be married before the older daughter. And so we had to give the older daughter to you first. I thought you knew that, Jacob, right? Shouldn't you? You have lived here for 7 years. And so it's Jacob's fault, right? But I'll tell you what, Jacob, you have worked well with us. I'll give you Rachel, too, right now, if you work for me 7 more years, right? So what does Jacob do? He has no choice. Right? He has already slept with the woman, and so he has to marry her. And he wants Rachel too, and to do that, he has to work 7 more years. And so that's exactly what he does. For Rachel, he works 7 more years. And so for 14 years, he ends up serving his uncle. And those were some tough years, because Uncle Laban was not a good man at all. So lesson number 2, out of a messed up family, God can form a diamond. Out of a messed up family, God can form a diamond. God can so often and does use these messed up families and people for his purpose. Right? Jacob becomes the father of a very proud Jewish nation, Israel. Right? But think about how messed up this first family was. So mother plots against the father, right? And she favors one son, and then he favors the other son, and she ditches her older son in favor of the younger son. Now, we're not even talking about stepsons and stepbrothers or half-brothers or anything like that. I mean, they're both her true sons, but she just favors the younger one and plots against her own husband to deceive him so that her younger son, the favored one, will be blessed. How messed up is that? And then the older son, when he finds out, rather than forgiving, he wants to come and kill him. Right? Cain's blood is running through him. And then goes to uncle's house, and who's supposed to be sympathetic to all of this, and he just tricks him out of his life, right? And takes 14 years out of his life. And then on top of that, right? I mean, how sad is it, right? I mean, this uncle was a master trickster. I mean, think about it. He had a dilemma because he had a beautiful daughter that he knew that he wouldn't have any problem marrying off, right? But he had not so beautiful daughter in the older daughter. He had to marry her off, but he didn't know any way to do that. And so he decided to trick his own nephew to do that. And then out of that, he gets 14 years of great service. He gets to marry off, right? The beauty and the ugly duckling. And then on top of that, he gets 14 years out of service. I mean, that's beautiful, but all at whose expense? His nephew's expense. What a nightmare of a family. What a messed up family, right? If you make the connection, you can kind of understand where Rebecca got that kind of mentality, wouldn't you? Why she became so deceitful. Think about Rebecca and her brother Laban, right? They're both deceitful people. And yet Rebecca is the one that God chose to become the wife to the child of the promise, which is Isaac. Right? So God knew this, and he still used these people and used this family to bring about good. And so it is really, literally true that God uses such messed up families to form a diamond out of it. Why in the world would God do that? Why would he do that? To give you and me hope. Right? How many of us come from an ideal family? Right? You look at your family and you go, you know, I come from a perfect family. No. Right? Anything but that, some of us. But God can cut a diamond out of coal, and he relishes. God relishes in the fact that he picks the worst of conditions and worst of people and brings about the good, so that once again, all credit goes to who? Not us. But to God. I told you, it's all about Christ. So if you come from a messed up family and you look at your family and you go, yep, I totally identify with Jacob. That's so messed up. Guess what? God is for you, right? He can use your family. Don't think your children have no chance just because you come from such a messed up family, right? Seek God. Pray for God's favor and mercy. He loves the underdog. Okay? Back to the story. Finally, after serving his uncle for 14 years and the commitment is now over, Jacob, understandably, wants to leave the family, right? Leave the uncle's family and then have his own family somewhere else, away from this evil uncle. Plus, God appears before Jacob and says, well, Jacob, I want you to now go back home where you came from. And so he is gathering his wives, right? And now many children and flocks on top of that, and he wants to go back home. One problem. What's the problem? His brother. Remember why he left in the first place, right? Because his brother Esau wanted to kill him. And at this point, he doesn't know whether his brother is still angry at him and still wants to kill him or will welcome him back. Back then, there was no Facebook where you could face stalk somebody and kind of get the mood for something, right? And so what he does instead is he sends messengers to his brother to kind of get a feel for where his brother is. Right? And so he basically tells the messengers to tell him that your brother Jacob is coming back with, you know, a whole bunch of people. And messengers come back and reports back to him saying that your brother is coming out to meet you with 400 men. Okay? What is Jacob thinking? What does that mean? Right? Is he coming out to have a huge party, like welcome party for me? Remember, it's been more than like 15, 16 years since they last saw each other, and they didn't end in good terms, right? Now he's coming back, and he's coming out to meet me with 400 people. Like, is he gonna wipe me out? Is he gonna kill all my kids and me and everything that I own? Or is he coming out to have a welcome party? He doesn't know, right? He doesn't know. And the passage that we just read is what happened the night before he was to meet his brother, right? And a weird thing happens. Okay, weird thing happens. This man comes out of nowhere and they wrestle together. Jacob and this man wrestle together on the night before, probably the, you know, Jacob's biggest moment, right? They wrestle all night and this man just touches Jacob's hip socket and it gets out of joint. And so he becomes limp, right? He becomes crippled. Yet he will not let go of this being. And somehow Jacob intuitively knew that this person was just more than just a man. And he demands a blessing from this man. Unless you bless me, I will not let go. And he's holding on to him all night until the daybreak. And finally, when the day broke, the man goes to Jacob, let me go. It's time for me to go. And Jacob goes, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. And he was determined, right? He was already crippled, and he's still hanging on to this man. And the man asks Jacob a very weird question. He goes, "So, what's your name?" Right? Why? Because last time somebody asked Jacob, "What's your name?" What did Jacob say? Esau. He lied to his dad. His dad asked him, "What's your name?" He said, "Esau, your firstborn. Feel me, smell me, bless me." And this man asked Jacob, "What is your name?" And Jacob, I'm sure, thought about it, truthfully says, "It's Jacob." And then this being says, "You're no longer Jacob. Your name will be Israel, and you will be father to a nation." Only God in the Old Testament and the New changed a person's name. Only God can do that. A side note, do you remember how Jesus changed Peter's name, right? That shows you something, who Jesus was, okay? So, Jacob, finally, it dawns on him, this was not no mere man, right? This was the very God. I have seen God face to face, and I have wrestled with God, and I survived. And that's why he named it Peniel, right? The face of God. This was a lesson for Jacob, and this is a third lesson. Okay? Third lesson is this: there will come a time in all of our lives, in all of us in our lives, a crisis of faith that will set the course for the rest of our lives. Crisis, okay? C-R-I-S-I-S, crisis of faith that will set the course for the rest of our lives, depending on how we choose. The crisis of faith is this. It's whatever makes you think, seriously, do I choose my will? I have to just make important decisions that's going to affect me for the rest of my life. But do I choose God's will, or do I choose my will? Do I trust God in what he said about this decision, or do I trust my own wits and my own wisdom in doing it my way? That is a crisis of faith, because at that point, you don't know what to do, right? That's exactly where Jacob is on that night. If it were up to him, what do you think he will do? The best thing is not to meet his brother, right? He's coming out with 400 men, and he has no idea what he's going to do. And so the best thing to do is flee, go somewhere else. But God told him to go back to your own land. It would have been really nice if God also said, by the way, I'm going to give you a vision, and this is exactly how it's going to play out. You're going to go, and Esau's going to come, and he's going to get off of his horse, and he's going to give you a huge hug and big party and all of that. So don't worry, that's going to happen. If he did that, then Jacob could have gone, phew, okay, it's going to work out. But God doesn't. He simply says, go back to your home. He doesn't tell him what kind of consequences will befall him. And so Jacob is nervous, and he's having a nervous breakdown, and that's why he stays up all night. And what is he doing? He's literally wrestling with God, right? Metaphorically speaking, he's wrestling with God. Is it going to be my will? Is it going to be your will? I want your blessing, God, right? I want to do it your way. I don't want to do it my way. Exactly what Deborah shared about today, right? I know every time I do it my way, I wasted 17 years, because I try to do it my way. I want to do it your way, but it's so hard because I just can't see how that's going to be good for me. That crisis of faith. All of us, if we're Christians, will come to that moment where we are at a crossroads. Do you go this way, God's way, or do you go your way? What you know to be right, what you know makes sense, what you think will make your life the happiest. Because if you were to choose God's will and God doesn't come through, it will have some horrific consequences sometimes. It's almost like God asks you to go past the cliff. And then as soon as you take a step past the cliff and put your weight on it, there will appear a bridge to hold you up. But when you look down, all you see are the rocks 100 meters down, right? And you're asking God, it will help me so much if you can just make the bridge appear before I take the step. But God says, no, I want you to take the step. Only after you take the step and put full weight on it, then I'll make the bridge appear. And so you are at a deadlock. God, show me. And God goes, no, take the step. Right? That's a step of faith. Well, that sounds like blind faith to me, Pastor Hong, right? That's like presuming on God. No, it's not, because first of all, God told him. And then, second, he had his grandfather, Abraham, who's done the same thing. Right? And then his father, Isaac, who's also done the same thing. So God has given him evidence to follow. What God is trying to do is, so far, Jacob, I'm not your God, right? I'm the God of your grandfather. I'm the God of your father, but I'm not your God yet, because you have not taken a step out in faith yet. But after this moment, after this happens, and if you respond in the right way, I will be your God, right? I'll be your God. And you know what Jacob did? He took the step out in faith. And in the New Testament, whenever God is mentioned, he always says, right, Jesus says, and the Pharisees also say, he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because he became his God, I believe, at this moment. Right? So you come to this crisis of faith in your life. You will, if you haven't already. And when it comes, remember this God, who led countless people in the Old Testament and the New for thousands of years, all culminating in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And even after that, millions of people have given their lives happily, joyfully, to serve this God, because they found out that once they stepped out on faith and took that risk for God, God came through them. So take that step, right? Choose Jesus. Choose his way. And let faith arise. To finish the story, the next day, Jacob, I think this shows a change of his heart. The night before this happened, he arranged his encampment. So he put all of his animals first, and then his least favorite sons and daughters next, and then concubines and so on, and then the second wife's sons and daughters right there, and then Rachel and her sons last, right? And that's how he was going to go. In case, you know, Esau comes out swinging, you know, he's going to go, okay, I can at least save the latter ones. But he just chucks all of that. He goes to the front, and he was behind, you know, Rachel, okay? He's the last one. But next day arrives, he goes to the very front of the line, right? Goes all the way to the front, and he's the first one to meet his brother Esau. And you know what happened, right? Esau forgives, accepts him back, hugs, happy ending. Okay. Conclusion. Jacob's story ends there, but see, this is part of a far greater story of Jesus Christ. All of this is leading up to the revealing of God's Son in Jesus Christ, who also wrestled with God in the Garden of Gethsemane the night before he was to be captured. Although Jacob had a happy ending, Jesus did not have such a happy ending, did he? Because the night after wrestling with God, pass this cup away from me, and he prayed it three times, that's wrestling all night with God. God said, no, I demand your blood. And so on the cross, his hands were bound, his feet were bound, crown of thorns, and he was choked to death. Right? He spared Jacob, but he did not spare his own son. For your sake and for my sake. God only touched Jacob's hip and made him crippled, but God pierced his heart, pierced his hands, pierced his head, killing him in the end. Again, for your sake and my sake. So it's all about Jesus. It's all about how Christ would fulfill all these other people that have only in shadow, acted out what Christ would ultimately do. Abraham. God would not let Isaac die at the hands of Abraham, and yet he would let his son die on the cross. He would not let Joseph be abandoned by the grave by his own brothers, and yet he let his son be abandoned to the grave. And during Exodus, he would not let the spirit of death kill the firstborn children of Israel by painting lamb's blood on the doorpost so that when the spirit of death saw that, it simply passed over. However, in the New Testament, Jesus' own blood, the Lamb of God, His blood would be shed so that that blood will be painted over us so that when the spirit of eternal death would look at us, it would simply pass us over for your salvation and mine. So who should get the credit? Jesus Christ. He is the beginning. He is the ending. He is the middle. He is the way, the truth, and the life. He is not only the ticket to heaven. He is not only the ride to heaven. He is also the show. Right? He is who you meet, who you get there for. He is the beginning and end. He is the Alpha and Omega. He is everything. And every story is imbued with meaning beyond what appears. Every story has element of truth in it. And if it is true, then it's about Jesus Christ. I'm not talking about just biblical stories. Okay? I'm talking about all good stories. And this world is bristling with meaning beyond what it looks like to the eye. And they are pointing all to Jesus. So as you are enjoying the sun, as you're enjoying the blue skies, as you're enjoying the cherry blossoms, right? Just think, all these things are singing, bursting with joy, singing praises to Jesus Christ, who made everything meaningful. All right? Let's pray.